When we look at such an overwhelming challenge, such as violence, it's easy to feel hopeless. And yet, we've taken on such big issues in our country's past. I'm thinking of the very institution of slavery. On my recording, Searching for Heroes, I tell a longer version of this story about the Oberlin Rescue of 1858. But I wanted to tell it to you again here in its shorter, inspirational version without all the political twists and turns that I do in the longer story. Many of you know Oberlin. It's in Ohio in the Midwest in the U.S. And in the 1800s, it was the first town that had a college to admit women and black people, first to elect a public official who was black. They had a very strong anti-slavery stand, a place where they would not celebrate the 4th of July. They said, how can we celebrate independence, a freedom day, when there are millions of people held in bondage on the soil of the United States? Now imagine if you had been brought over from Africa. You don't know where you are. You don't speak the language. There's no maps, no internet, of course. But after years, Africans started to know the land, and more and more and more people were able to escape. The rewards were sometimes as high as $40,000. Imagine what that was worth in the 1800s. That's how much it was worth to have somebody who would work for free. But the system was cracking apart. There were such harsh punishments for Africans who fled, and still they kept running, helping each other out, making quilts that they'd hang on fences that were actually maps showing the way to the north, making false bottoms and wagons. Some of you have heard of Henry Box Brown that had himself mailed up north, right? So many people in Oberlin, they would not take these rewards. A town of 2,000, it was estimated that before the Civil War began, over 3,000 runaways had lived in Oberlin or passed through on their way to freedom. So the system was cracking. The rewards were not working. So the plantation owners, government people, all those benefiting from the institution of slavery started to enact punishments for people who would hide runaways. In 1850, the Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Law. Now, it said you had to identify any runaways. You had to assist in their recapture. And it was an offense to harbor or conceal anybody. And you would get a really stiff jail term and a really stiff fine that could bankrupt your whole family. But Oberlin said, no, we're ignoring it. We're just not going to do it. So many who supported slavery said, oh, we've got to find a way to punish Oberlin. They're causing trouble. Well, they had their chance. On a Kentucky plantation, just a quarter mile from the Ohio River, separating the North and South, lived John and Dinah, who were cousins. They were enslaved by a man named John Bacon. And John and Dinah wanted to escape. This John Bacon was known for his cruelty. And one night they had their chance. Bacon and his family went to go visit other relatives. And there were some men with guns who were supposed to watch them, but John and Dinah knew they also drank a bit and tended to fall asleep, so they waited for their chance. Now they knew the Ohio River was frozen. This was going to be the best time. So they snuck into the barn. And you can imagine, they got two horses, what it was like to try to keep those horses quiet and get out of that barn. And then they did an amazing thing. They were only a quarter a mile, right, from the Ohio River, separating North and South. Now, with the Fugitive Slave Law, you could be captured anywhere in the United States, but you still were safer up north. But instead of going over to the river, they went in the opposite direction. Not because they didn't know where they were going, but because they went to get their friend Frank, who also wanted to escape. So they met up with Frank, they gave him one horse, John and Dinah got on the other horse, and they hightailed it to the river. They slipped their way across that river, they got to the other bank, but then they couldn't find the path, the route up the cliffs to the other side. They were all night out there searching, hardly any warm clothes, but they knew as soon as that sun began to rise, three people, two horses would be easy to spot, right? It was winter, no leaves on the trees, they would be easy to spot. So finally, just at daybreak, somebody spotted the path and up they went. And then they decided to separate. Dinah going with some folks from their Underground Railroad, their hiding places, John and Frank with somebody else. And then they did to me an amazing thing. John said, nobody can own us, but Bacon did own these horses. Now, I don't know about you, but if my mother and grandmother had been enslaved by this guy and working for free all these years, I'd kind of feel like I owned those horses too. But John slapped them on the rear end and they went back across the river. And John and Frank went with their people from the Underground Railroad, and all kinds of things happened with hiding places and buggies tipping over and almost getting caught and all kinds of things. But they made it to Oberlin. And they were going to wait till Lake Erie thawed out and go into Canada. But when they got to Oberlin, it was an amazing sight. Imagine what they thought. They were black shopkeepers. They were black people who went to school versus being beaten if you tried to learn to read, right? They were black landowners. And there's this one farmer who was black who hired John and Frank. And they wound up staying there for 2 years. John even finally took a last name. He called himself John Price. He loved it in Oberlin. He was just going to stay. But what he did not know was that Bacon had sent slave catchers looking for him, Frank, and Dinah. One of these slave catchers was Anderson Jennings. Jennings got $1,000 for everybody he brought back into slavery. And though Oberlin was quite a progressive town, it was not like everyone was anti-slavery. Anderson Jennings approached a man and paid his son, 10-year-old Shakespeare Boynton, gotta like that name, Shakespeare Boynton, and he gave Shakespeare $20, which again was a lot of money. Now, John and Frank were working for this farmer who was black, who was giving them a dollar a day. This was a lot of money back then, and certainly a lot when you'd been working for free all your life. But Shakespeare Boynton drove up in a buggy and said to John, my father needs some help with the potatoes. He'll pay $2 for the day. Wow, double. But this is the kind of good friend that John was. He said, no, Frank's not feeling well. I better stay here. Phew, okay. But then John said, but I'll take you to somebody else who I know needs the work. So John got in the buggy with Shakespeare and off they went. And they're in the woods. And also John's like, no, my friend's over there. No, you got to turn this way. But Shakespeare kept driving. And all of a sudden another horse and buggy came racing up behind them. Men with guns got out. They nabbed John. They handcuffed him. They threw him in the buggy and off they went. Well, luckily, there was an Oberlin graduate student walking through the woods at the time, and he saw this whole thing go down. And so he went running into town, help, help, they've got John Price, they've captured John Price. And people began to flock out of town, this whole cavalcade, people on horseback, people went to the livery stations, rented buggies if they didn't have them. Some people went on foot. Now, Anderson Jennings and his men were headed to Wellington, Ohio. It was about 9 miles south of Oberlin. They didn't dare try to put John on a train for Kentucky in Oberlin, so they went to Wellington. And Anderson Jennings rented a little room in the attic of the Wadsworth Hotel. There was a square, town square out in front. He thought, I can be up here and I can see if we get any trouble coming our way before we can get on the train headed south. Well, imagine his surprise when he looked out that attic window, and by early afternoon, he saw 100 people fill the square. 200, 300, 400, 500, 600, 700, 700 people. More every hour. Now, remember, every one of these people was, every one of them, they were breaking the fugitive slave law. They were all risking imprisonment and horrible fines. Now, Anderson Jennings didn't take much for him to figure out he was outnumbered, so he had one of his men sneak over to the telegraph office and wire for soldiers. Remember, the fugitive slave law was a federal law. He could get federal marshals to help him. Well, the 5:15 train going south came and went because Anderson Jennings was not going to walk out into that mob. And the mob was getting more and more restless. Some people had tried ladders against the building to crawl in and what have you. But the rumor began to spread that there were going to be soldiers on the last train coming from up south to help Anderson Jennings get John on that train. Then they turned the train around and go back down south. So folks said, we better move. We better move now. We could get killed when these soldiers show up. So there were two groups, white, black, and brown. One took the front door of the Wadsworth Hotel, one took the back. And the front got up without too much trouble, though it was getting dark and there were no electric lights back then, right? So they're trying to find their way, scared a few people coming up the stairs. But the group in the back tried to get through, but one of Anderson Jennings' men was standing there with a rifle blocking the stairway. So one of the Oberlin men got impatient and he drew his rifle to fire at Jennings' men just when one of the Oberlin men hit the rifle barrel and the bullet hit the ceiling. He said, "No, no violence." Now, this was an African-American man who had the whip marks on his back to show that he could have wanted some revenge from when he had been enslaved. But no, he said, "No violence." Well, luckily, that shot to the ceiling was enough to frighten Jennings' man, and he ran off. So the Oberlin group in the back ran up the back stairs. Now, it kind of turns into a Keystone Cop, Laurel and Hardy kind of episode at this point, because they're in the dark, bumping into each other, moving through the hallways, trying to find where is Anderson Jennings holding John. And when John was, you know, captured up in that attic room and Jennings heard the Oberlin people in the hallway, he kind of leaned back his head to look through a hole where a stovepipe had been in this room they were holding John. Just as William Lincoln, gotta love the name, one of the Oberlin men, was inserting his gun into that hole where a stovepipe had been. And William's gun unwittingly knocked Jennings on the head, and Jennings fell down, let go of the door he was holding closed with a rope, because it turned out there wasn't even a lock on the door, and Lincoln and some of the other Oberlin men burst through the door. Remember, there was no electricity, it was pitch dark, but somehow in the mayhem, they managed to grab John. And it probably was the first time that Anderson Jennings really realized John was gone, because he heard this cheer go up from the people outside as soon as they got John. They whisked him away. Nobody knows for sure where he went. Never heard from him again. I like to think he got to Canada, met up with Dinah. Somehow Frank found them all. I don't know. We were never told, but I hope they were all together. But that was not the end of it. Remember, this was a federal law. So the federal marshals came marching into Oberlin and arrested 37 men. These were farmers, some legislators, ministers, a 74-year-old man, old, young, students, white, black. Now, there was only one person who had ever had any trouble before. He had gotten fined $1 for smoking a cigar on Oberlin streets. But I got to tell you, they arrested some men who weren't even at the Wadsworth Hotel. This is very political, as you can imagine. Anyway, the marshals showed up, and they're pulling people out of work, and they marched into a first-grade classroom to arrest one of the teachers. And this little child, 6 years old, stood up and said to the big old federal marshal, "Why, there's more goodness in his little finger than your whole carcass." They took these 37 men to maximum security in Cleveland. They had to make examples of them, right? They broke a federal law. But arresting them had the opposite effect. They became celebrities. Over 4,000 people visited them while they were in the Cleveland maximum security prison. Children wrote letters. Newspaper articles and speeches called them the new patriots. And when that trial began, and Anderson Jennings came up to testify, the Oberlin people nabbed him, arrested him for kidnapping John Price. And by the time they let Jennings out of their jail, he had had enough. He signed what they asked him to sign, an agreement they would never come to Oberlin again to do his job of catching previously enslaved people. Finally, the whole government's case against the 37 just dissolved and they were released. And when they stepped out of that Cleveland prison, there was a band there to greet them. "I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy." And cannons went off and they marched the people and sang them down to the train station. And they took the train back up to Oberlin. And that day they had a rally. And in that town of 2,000, there were over 4,000 to greet the 37 at the train station. And during this whole little meeting they had, this town meeting, the whole town stood up and pledged that never again would a runaway be taken from Ohio, and none ever was. They refused to be intimidated and divided. They had the power of their convictions and the courage to act on them. And so I look at all the challenges, personal, societal, that we have. I realize this is part of our legacy. We have come from people who will not be enslaved in body, mind, or spirit, who will risk everything for freedom. We are part of that legacy of Americans who won't believe in stereotypes, who will not be divided, who can face any challenge and win.